this is Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today is originally from New Zealand. He now lives in Paris. He began writing short stories and he's just published his prize-winning debut novel, Paper Cage. Tom Baragwanath, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Thank you very much, Georgina. It's great to be here.
Did I pronounce that right?
You know you did. You nailed it. That's really impressive. It's not an easy name.
Well, where's it from?
Well, it's Cornish originally. So I have family over here, mostly in the Midlands. My dad actually grew up in the Midlands and moved to New Zealand in his 20s.
Yeah. And you were born there?
I was born in New Zealand, yeah.
Whereabouts? Tell us about your early life and,
sure.
And just set the location for us.
Yeah, I mean, born in Wellington in the capital, but grew up in the Wairarapa, which is where the book is set, in Masterton. And spent some time in Masterton town itself, but mostly in quite a remote rural community called Wanuru, which is out towards the coast there. So it's, you know, about a half hour's drive to the nearest milk, for example. So, yeah.
Why were you out there?
It's my stepfather's sheep and beef station. Has been in his family for a while. And yeah, so I grew up there, splitting my time between the Wairarapa and then my dad in the Waikato was a dairy farmer as well. So
yeah. A real farm boy?
I guess so, yeah. I'm not that rural. I've got siblings who are far, far more sort of legitimately rural than I am. Yeah. I can do a few things. I can mend a fence here or there or whatever. But my brother Guy really takes the mantle for that. So.
All right, but you are wearing a check shirt.
Yeah, that's right. Well, it's obligatory. Yeah, yeah.
So tell us about Masterton, because that is where the book is set.
Yeah, I mean, it's it for a long time has been kind of a hub for all of the rural communities around there. I mean, Masterton, it's actually growing quite a lot since I was a kid. I mean, it's, I think, around 40 plus thousand people there now. No, and I mean, it for me, it's somewhere that has always sort of lodged in my imagination, and especially since moving overseas, I've sort of am living part of my life, my mental life, if you will, like in that small town. And so, yeah, very small town, a lot of driving to get anywhere, not great public transport. I actually went to school just outside of Masterton at a boarding school about sort of 15 minutes drive away from Masterton, so... Yeah.
And an industrial town, a farming town?
It's more of a farming town. I would say that it's mostly petrol stations, you know, machinery workshops, and then there's one main street with a few cafes and a cinema and supermarkets. And, you know, it's for a long time, it's been a bit of a hub of part of New Zealand that isn't really that well serviced by a lot of other amenities. So it's kind of a hub for, I would say, a satellite of about sort of four or five other smaller towns as well.
Right.
Yeah.
So there you are. You're splitting your time between these two rural stations.
Yeah.
You're at boarding school. What happens then? You leave school and?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fairly typical story for a lot of people coming out of school. So I went to university in Wellington and studied a few more dry subjects. I studied law and political science and anthropology and then went into the public service for a while. And during that time, I sort of was always tinkering away with short stories. And really, because that was the format that best suited the amount of spare time I had. And then, yeah, I ended up studying a short program in short fiction at Victoria University. And that really sort of made me understand what I could try and do in terms of storytelling and how my storytelling was coming across. So.
Mm. You talk about working in the public service. Some of that was sort of on environment and climate?
That's right, yeah. So I started off in Māori development policy, actually. So working mostly in Māori land policy and quite niche sort of bits of legislation around like Māori wardens and some other issues within New Zealand as well. And yeah, I went into climate policy, mostly working around the ETS as well.
ETS.
Yeah. Oh, the Emissions Trading Scheme. Yeah,
right.
My apologies. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So there has been a big sort of shift in, well, a referendum, in fact, on Māori legislation. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, this is the thing, and I should say right off the bat, I mean, I've been out of the country for, it's been about 6 years now, so there would be people that are far more sort of clued into the day-to-day than I am. But yeah, no, with the recent change of government, so part of the deal was there was to be, at least the National Party would support through to the select committee stage, a bill looking at the references to Treaty of Waitangi principles within legislation.
And what is that treaty?
Yeah, so this is the country's essential founding document, so 1840, this agreement between the Māori people and you know, white colonial settlers. And essentially, the main project of Treaty of Waitangi, a sort of modern policy since the 70s, has been this recognition of rights to self-determination and sovereignty over land. And essentially what's happening now is we have this sort of shift to the right, and it's a little bit of, I think, playing to the base that people aren't so keen on seeing, you know, too many signs in te reo Māori, aren't so keen on seeing entrenched references to Māori rights within legislation, within sort of public legislation. And it's a little bit of... It's been an interesting thing to watch from far away, because I think this kind of commitment as part of the most recent coalition of government with the ACT Party, it's a little bit of lip service to that. I don't know that necessarily the National Party was actually going to unpick all of this work that's been done since the 70s, because many, many figures within the National Party are very diehard supporters of this project to do with greater recognition of the Treaty of Waitangi principles. And so, no, it's an interesting time. I can't really tell, being this far away, how much of this debate is sort of genuine and legitimate, or how much of the debate is, yet again, just paying lip service to a kind of silent group of voters that have always felt a little bit uncomfortable with the level of recognition of Māori rights within legislation in the present day.
Right, yeah. And this all becomes very relevant in the book because, of course, there's a great deal to do with race, which we'll get onto. So how did you and why did you leave?
Yeah, I mean, I was sort of working too much in New Zealand, and we were getting to that point, my wife and I, where if we wanted to have a stab at living somewhere else, we needed to pull the pin on that and do it. And the more practical reason is that I've got a British passport because of my dad, and we wanted to come and try and settle somewhere before Brexit.
So, right.
Yeah, so we arrived and managed to get in there before that happened, so yeah.
And why Paris?
Yeah, I mean, my wife studied French, and she had an offer to do, it's an exchange between the New Zealand Law Society and the French version of that. So she had this offer to come and do this great exchange, like academic exchange, and then that led into some job opportunities, and I was ready to not work for a little while and try and work on some writing, like longer form.
Right, yeah. And so, but your short stories in the meanwhile continued and widely published.
Yeah. I mean, they did find a home in some magazines and newspapers, which was really great. I still enjoy reading some of them. Some of them have this kind of waft of the early writer about them. It's a little bit like, hey, isn't my life so interesting? Look, what if I transpose this stuff that happened to me into a story? And what, you know, so yeah, I'm hoping to leave more of that behind as I get on in my career.
Yeah. And you talked about doing this short course about writing short form fiction.
Yeah.
What does that teach essentially? I mean, because we're always told that short stories are much harder to write than anything longer.
Yeah, I mean, it teaches, for me, the biggest thing that it taught me was how much of a performance that a short story has to be. So a novel, you can have some ragged sort of edges here and there, and, you know, hopefully not too much, but it's a little shaggier, right? But then the short story is kind of this form where everything has to be essential, and if you remove anything, then the whole short story should fall over,
right?
Ideally in the model of Chekhov and all the originals, right? But I would say that the main thing this course taught me was how my stuff was coming across to an audience, because, again, the early writer, you're just so passionate about what you're doing, and you don't really have a sense of, well, how is this going to come across to a reader? And I'm not sure what kind of language I'm able to use on the podcast.
Whatever you like.
Yeah, I mean, most of the feedback from my lovely castmates was, okay, the story has some cool stuff, but this narrator sounds like a real asshole, and you need to fix that. And the thing was, they were right, and that's really good feedback to get. I wasn't quite ready to get that feedback at the time, and so I had to work on, I guess, making, even I could have some cynical narrators, some characters that were not entirely likable, but to have the voice of the piece be a little more welcoming and empathetic was the project.
Yeah. And was that, do you think, a problem with yourself as less mature?
Oh, I would say so. Yeah, probably. I mean, I was in my mid-20s, and you know, maybe a little judgier or judgier in different ways than I am now. So
yeah. So you moved to Paris. It's great. Your wife's got this wonderful legal job.
Yeah.
And you can just sit around and write.
Yeah, I mean, the thing was, I was teaching English at the same time, and then I started freelancing in marketing as well, which kind of led into the day job that I have now. I mean, I work in content for a French startup that deals in cybersecurity. And so that I do that sort of a few days a week, and then I've got some time for writing, and I also teach at the moment as well. But yes, certainly when we first arrived, I had this incredibly luxurious amount of time to try and work on some longer stories. And that was both kind of a blessing and a curse, really, because what I've realized now, and I'm sure this is true of a lot of writers, is you actually need the day-to-day, the banal office exchanges. All of that stuff becomes fuel for what you're writing about.
Yeah.
And when I was writing every day and teaching English, I almost had too much time to focus on my writing. And I didn't have enough sort of chaff to feed the machine, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And it's really also very interesting about writing about a place once you've left it. Many people say they can't write about it whilst they're in there.
That has been very true for me. When I was in Wellington and in Macedon, I mean, I was able to write stories set there. But since I've been away, I think it's because I miss it so much, it's really clarified my interest in why I like the place. And the other thing, truthfully, is I've tried to write a couple of short stories set in Paris. Even though we've been there for a while and my French is okay and, you know, I can get by, I don't really know the city enough to write about it. And what I really don't want to do, and no offense to anyone, any other writers, the world has enough stories about, you know, Anglophone people moving to Paris and writing sort of extended flowery descriptions of the cobblestones and we don't need any more of that.
And the world certainly doesn't have enough of books like this, which covers everything from climate, from race relations, small town living, and of course political commentary. It's this very tightly wrought thriller.
Great.
It's a crime novel. I mean, did you think of yourself as a crime novelist?
No, not at all. And you know, I've just written an essay about this that came out in the last few days, but no, absolutely not. When I first started writing this, I mean, I was working on it as part of a master's program at Kent University. It actually has a satellite campus in Paris. And really it began with a conversation with Lorraine, the main character, that is like a little bit like my mum, a little bit like some of our cousins, you know, a kind of amalgamation of some people very dear to me in my life. And then it really, that voice turned into, okay, well, what could she encounter? What would be going on in her sort of basement filing room? And that's when it really turned into, I guess you might call it a crime story. But no, certainly at the start, my interest in this world was not really about missing kids or about any of the sort of capital C crime stuff. And I think maybe that's why, I mean, a lot of the readers have said it's a little deeper on character and a little more like the relationship that one forms with Lorraine is a bit different from what you might form with hard-boiled crime stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a police procedural without she actually being a proper member of the police or following any kind of procedure.
Of course. And, you know, that's super useful for me because I'm quite lazy and I didn't want to research any of the procedural stuff.
Yeah.
I got in touch with a friend of mine who's an officer in Marston, a police officer, and the only thing that I asked him was, does the cop shop have a basement? And he said, no. And I said, oh, okay. Do you know what? In the book it does, so that's fine. But no, I mean, the thing is because I enjoy reading a lot of crime and watching crime shows and stuff, but the procedural stuff for me is kind of like, I don't know, it's just, it's the canvas. And you don't really want to call attention too much to it. I don't know. So
Yeah. So let's set up the book because people really should read it. It's a fabulous book. So we're in this town, this small-ish town, and kids start going missing. But tell us more about the racial aspect of it, because it's not just any children that are going missing.
No, that's it. And really where this comes from with me is there's been this quite hotly contested issue of what we call uplifting practices. So where the state will step in and essentially take a child that's invulnerable in tough conditions into state care. And predominantly this has been happening with Māori families. And for me, looking at this issue as a Pākehā writer, as someone, you know, from New Zealand who isn't Māori, I really was chewing this over and thinking, well, what does this mean for me? How should I make sense of this, and what are my duties in relation to this issue and to this trend? Because so much of it is so directly connected with our colonial past, with our history of injustice and inequity. And, you know, no one wants to read a book that is a sort of manifesto or a treatise posing as a novel, right? So what I really had to do was keep that sort of on the burner in the back of my mind, but really understand that was the big engine of why I'm interested in this story. And I hope it comes through in ways that are subtle enough not to mess with the enjoyment of the actual book.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, all of these kids then are from really deprived homes.
Yeah, and it's really, some of them are in sort of like truly tricky situations where there's drug use, and it is quite vulnerable in that sense. And then some, really, it's not that they're directly threatened, but I don't want to get into it too much, but the person or persons that are behind this perceive them to be such. And really what I wanted to do was unpick those kinds of attitudes of racial paternalism that are so sort of baked into some parts of New Zealand society and really put that under the magnifying glass.
Yeah. Your main protagonist is Lorraine. She's a woman, a white New Zealand woman. Lots of kids in here who are Māori, lots of descriptions of Māori lives, lots of Māori words. Of course, you're going to come up against this whole discussion on cultural appropriation.
Yeah, and I welcome it because, I mean, I can't exactly remember the idiom, but there's a whakatoki, a proverb within Māori, and I'm going to butcher the original, but it essentially translates into, you know, that which you care about, you argue about. And so I welcome this kind of discussion and this argument. But yeah, my whole approach to this is I recognise coming into it that as a Pākehā, my standing is not as such to describe the truly sort of day-to-day authentic lived experience of Māori families, of Māori communities. But really to take a great deal of care in trying to unpick, again, attitudes of racial paternalism that come from within Pākehā communities as well. That's something that I can have, you know, experience having heard and seen some of that growing up.
Mm.
And I think getting the chance to unpick that and really examine it in a book was super satisfying. But the own voices debate, I welcome it. I follow it super closely. And
I had to keep looking words up. Pākehā, for instance.
Oh, sure,
I had no idea, but I was like, so what colour is this word?
yeah. No, and that's it. And I mean, part of, because, you know, when I was younger, I read a lot of like Saul Bellow and Philip Roth. And what I really enjoyed about reading books that had a lot of, for example, like Yiddish in the original, is that as a kid, I didn't understand what, you know, schmuck or chutzpah, I didn't understand what any of these words meant. But within the context, you get the sense of what's happening. And to try and use that as sort of like teaching the reader what's going on, mm-hmm. as opposed to footnoting anything or, you know. And my only hope is that people don't stop and use Google too much.
Because it breaks the flow, of course. But how true is use of that word, those words, within white New Zealand society? I mean, how integrated and what is the kind of state of race relations, would you say?
Oh, I mean, my standing to answer that question, you know, I haven't lived in the country for a few years now, but I would say on the question of usage of te reo Māori, it is something that, you know, I would say mainstream society, it's become more and more accepted over time. You know, you have road signs in Māori now, you have names of government departments that are in Māori, and it's used a lot more in public media as well, including a lot of public-facing publications that are put out by the government, which I think has been a fantastic step forward since the 70s,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, because I used to work in Māori policy, I had a lot to do with women like Dame Nida Glavish, who originally was essentially censured in her job for using kia ora, which is now a commonplace, you know, greeting in her job answering phones. And so, you know, we've come a long way, but there's still so much work to do. And I think what you see in the using words like whānau and pepi for family and baby, you know, these are words that within New Zealand it's becoming more and more accepted to just use them. And if you don't sort of keep up, it's kind of on you. And you know, we talked earlier in this discussion about the bill looking to review references to the Māori language within government legislation. This is kind of a bit of that backlash. It's almost gone. It's gone fast enough and thoroughly enough that now there is a bit of hay to be made if you're a political party looking to kind of examine and feed that fire of discontent among some parts of the population that don't want to see so much te reo Māori use. Mm. So,
interesting. The book starts with this huge storm.
Yeah.
And I just wondered if you could talk to us a little bit about that, because as we said, you've done some work on climate. And this is a kind of little theme that runs, a sort of sub-theme that runs through the background of the book.
Yeah, and I must say that was mostly unconscious on my part. But now looking at it, I mean, the thing is, coming from a rural community where we've had some incredibly dry summers and some incredibly wet winters in this last little while, everything's getting that little bit more pronounced in terms of climate. Yeah, it's definitely on my mind a lot, and having worked in that area too. But no, I must say, the eels in the gutter, this is, I don't want to lift the curtain too much, but this is ripped entirely from YouTube, because that genuinely happened. And there's a clip of a guy walking around his street looking at all these eels in the gutter and commenting on them, and it's just really great fun to watch. this is something that happened, I think it would be about 10 years ago now, it must be, but a fairly sizable flood. And the Rōmahanga River sort of runs alongside Macedon, and it does happen. It does flood some streets and neighbourhoods,
And in terms of the sort of wider environmental crisis that's affecting us all, I wonder how apparent and how aware New Zealanders are of all of that.
Oh, very much so. I think, you know, we've had some reasonably far-reaching attempts to try and, I guess, curtail, in terms of emissions, curtail our activity in that sense, and kind of look at some more reasonable solutions, as to say, okay, well, look, we're a country that farming is essentially, you know, it's kind of cliche, but it is such a big part of the economy. How can we move past the more emissions intensive forms of farming and look at more sustainable ways of doing that? And, you know, I think great steps have been made forward, but there is this kind of intractable issue, which is where you have so much land that has been deforested and converted into, for example, dairy blocks. And, you know, what do you do about that now? Like, incentivizing people to plant again, you're going to change communities a lot in that sense as well. So, no, there's interests on all sides of the debate, I would say.
Mm. Yeah. Let's talk about Lorraine, because her character is fascinating and very, very finely drawn. I mean, we really see into her life. Where did she come from? You say your mother and various others, but tell us about the development of that character.
Sure. Well, the voice and her speech is just within me all the time, right? So that when you are speaking to people from Macedon, from sort of rural parts of New Zealand, this is how they speak. And so what I would say is that within my family and sort of very close family friends as well, there are so many examples to draw from that part of it was not hard to come to. The challenging part was thinking, okay, well, if I'm just enjoying having this conversation with the character so much as the writer, I better make sure that it's also interesting for the reader too, and we don't end up with too much about the biscuit selection or, you know. So, yeah, that's really where that came from. And homesickness is an amazing creative fuel as well. I really, you know, we've been back to visit a few times in these last few years, but I do miss the place so much. And, you know, working on a story like this, it's like having an unending conversation with the people you miss the most. So,
yeah. Tell us about the title, Paper Cage.
Oh, sure. Well, again, I don't want to lift the curtain too much on this, but the manuscript was submitted for the Michael Gifkins Prize, for which it eventually was given the award, under a different title. And so my editor suggested the name Paper Cage. So it was originally called Lo, as in the biblical Lo, but also Lorraine, as in that's her nickname, right? And my editor said, look, no, this kind of book does not have a title like that. How about Paper Cage? And I thought, man, that's really insightful. How did she come up with that? That title is just so spot on. And then I was rereading the draft as part of the process, and I realized I myself had written that term in one of the earlier chapters and forgotten about it. And so I was giving her maybe like too much credit for coming up with the title. But no, we ended up cutting the use of that term within the chapter itself, just so it wasn't cheesy. But I think from Mandy, my editor, part of why she suggested the title is it has a lot of different resonant meanings. I mean, for Lorraine, she is literally in a cage of paper in her filing room. But it also, in a kind of more extended way, there is a way that some people in New Zealand would think of the Treaty of Waitangi as almost being a cage for modern Māori societies as well. It's not a view that I agree with necessarily, but and it manifests itself in certain ways within the book.
I think it's a great title and, as you say, absolutely very spot on. So I want to talk a little bit about the role that art plays in confronting societal problems.
Oh, sure.
I mean, as you say, you didn't set out to kind of lecture anybody, but there is a definite parallel here, isn't there?
Yeah. Well, no, I think that's a fantastic question. I mean, I think that it's really the medium through which many people either unconsciously, I think mostly unconsciously, end up arriving at positions on quite vexing issues like this. And for me, you know, reading the work of Patricia Grace, of Whittier Maira, a lot of these books sort of give you a means to understand a lot of different viewpoints within the country you're living in, right? Really, I mean, I did want to have something that was enjoyable on a kind of gut level and then left people with not answers but questions, right? Because you don't want a novel that actually answers these kinds of hard questions or tries to, because it's going to be bad. And so, that's really what I wanted to do, is kind of almost excavate enough of these quite gnarly questions that would leave the reader chewing things over a little bit after she's finished. So.
Tell us more about the New Zealand writing scene. I mean, I really, for me, as a child, I was a huge fan of, I always mispronounce it, Naya Marsh.
Oh, sure, yeah. It's funny. So the book was shortlisted for this. So there's an annual series of crime awards for New Zealand crime fiction called the Naya Marsh Awards. I read a lot of her when I was younger as well, and really enjoyed her flair and her passion for the form. And I mean, she's one of the greats, you know. But yeah, the contemporary scene, you know, it's super prolific. In fact, I have a review of the book today in the Daily Mail, of all places. Against another contemporary of mine, Rebecca Riley, who just wrote this book, Greta and Valdin, which is a wonderful, like, cracking book. It couldn't be more different from Paper Cage, but it's really, really wonderful read, so everyone should check that out. But no, the scene is prolific. I mean, there are like dozens of new books every year. When the book was launched in New Zealand at Unity Books in Wellington, I think there were 3 launches that week. So, you know, there's a lot going on. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of it remains unseen by the international community, but yeah, there's plenty going on there. Yeah.
And is it writing, is it mostly contemporary stuff? Is there one genre in particular that shines out from that?
Yeah, I think, I mean, there is a lot of crime stuff that's coming out. I mean, so I was joined by Fiona Sussman and Michael Bennett and a few other contemporary crime writers as part of being shortlisted for the Naya Marsh Awards, which is great. There is a lot of crime coming out as well, but I think, yeah, it's just essentially contemporary Aotearoa literature as well of all genres. Yeah.
And is there much Māori writing?
Yeah, I mean, there are plenty of Māori representation happening within a lot of the writing communities at the moment. It's a scene that I think more and more publishers are looking to make space for Māori voices as well.
So, yeah. Now, you're published by Text, and it was a 2-book deal, so...
Yeah. That's a great question. So I have been working on a sequel. Essentially, the big debate for me has been, okay, so we've got Lorraine. I'm still really interested in this, in the same issues that you and I have been talking in terms of racial paternalism and et cetera. But really, it's trying to make room for a sequel that is truly kind of standalone in that same sense. So no, I've been working on some stories, and I think it's going to be promising in the next little while to wrap that up.
And yeah. when you say working on stories, and given your short story background, is that how your novel came together? Is it writing your short little bits and then?
Yeah, I mean, the thing, because I wrote short stories first, I think it comes to me to make each chapter have its own build-up, payoff, its own development, its kind of its own movement as a short story. When I did work on this, it was, because I was in a workshop, in a master's workshop, it kind of was as a series of interlinked short stories that then connected to a wider plot in that sense. So, yeah.
Quite a difficult thing to do, though.
Yeah, certainly. And it really helped to get really honest, sort of frank feedback from my contemporaries in the class as well. And as a teacher of that same program now at Kent University, I'm kind of trying to dispense suggestions in that same vein and getting it right some of the time, I think so.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, I think you got it spot on.
Oh, thank you so much.
The book is Paper Cage. It's published by Baskerville. It's by Tom Baragwanath. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of Tamsin Howard, Neoma Ekwe and Mariella Bevan. And you can download this show and previous episodes from our website or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.